League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Member Week is here at Lowe's. Don't miss your chance to get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, faucets, vanities, doors, and more. Shop our exclusive deals happening in-store and online now through July 18th. Not a member? Join My Lowe's Pro Rewards for free today and get ready to save more. Lowe's, we help you save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to accomplished UK small and mid-cap fund manager Paul Jordan of Amati Global. So welcome, Paul.
Good morning, Paul. Very nice to be with you again.
Yeah, well, we've had a ton of volatility over the last week, not least last Monday's sort of extreme moves on the market caused by sort of like fears over a US recession, but more importantly, sort of the unwinding of the yen carry trade. But before we go through your sort of like view for equities going forward, I don't suppose you could quickly remind the audience what kind of stocks you are like and what kind of investor you are.
Yeah, I mean, we are a small cap investor, so we invest in the bottom 10% broadly of the UK stock market. We actually also run an AIM VCT, which is investing in much earlier stage companies as well. So our research, if you like, covers quite a big gamut of UK companies in all sectors. And we kind of see ourselves as pretty long-term investors. And we're obviously looking for companies that we think have got the right qualities to grow over the long term and therefore make good returns. So we're trying to sort of think companies through carefully in respect of their long-term prospects. Not an easy thing to do, as you know, but it's what we set our stall out to do.
And how's that long-term strategy sort of like fared over the past sort of 3 or 5 years, et cetera, since inception?
Oh, well, those are very different questions because
take it when you like.
26 years now, pretty much. So I've been doing this a long time, but the last 3 to 5 years have been, as I'm sure you know, a difficult place for UK small cap, having had a brilliant time between 2010 and 2021 broadly. Since 2021, it's been a very rocky road for small companies for all kinds of reasons. But you know, rising interest rates, rising inflation, much more negative sentiment, fears over global conflict. All of these things are not good, not a good backdrop for small cap. And you know, in addition to that, and you know, the sort of really big investment theme that's got a lot of investors very excited over the last year in particular is AI. And AI is a more difficult theme for small cap because actually, if you think about it, the companies that are really set to make a lot of money out of AI, or so they think they are anyway, are the sort of super major technology companies. And obviously, a huge amount of VC money is going into deploying AI. But really, the only companies that can afford to do the AI fundamentals, as in build the kind of AI plumbing and the models themselves, are the super majors, because it's such an expensive proposition, such an expensive job. So small companies are really sort of there kind of deploying these tools, but not really being total masters of them. But, you know, of course, there are some very good, interesting things to do with them. For me, that's more about machine learning than it is large language models. I haven't yet seen anybody make a lot of money out of large language models, but machine learning is a much more mature technology, and it's been there for a long time. And, you know, there's some companies that are deploying that very effectively. Yeah. But, you know, this super big theme that investors are poured into, it was really about US tech, and in a way that's just drained money away from UK small cap. So it's been quite a difficult backdrop the last 3 years.
And then sort of like going forward, when you look at sort of like small caps, the outlook, etc., when you overlay sort of the valuation perspective, if you look at it on a sort of PEG ratio, a price earnings growth rate, I think NASDAQ trades at nearly two times, about 1.8, 1.9, whereas AIM, I think the last time I calculated, it was 0.8. So it's less than half on a PEG ratio basis. So putting all that together, yes, there might not be sort of like right at the center or the heart of the AI revolution, but the valuations have come down to such extreme levels. It presumably, if you do get any type of mean reversion, then small caps or mid caps, what's your thoughts anyway?
No, I mean, you're spot on with that. And, you know, we are, I think, you know, pretty positive about the outlook for UK small cap. Really, because there is a lot, you know, there's a lot of mean reversion. It's now become, we think, an under-owned segment of the stock market. It's becoming a neglected segment of the stock market. You can't index track it, really. And there's a lot of interesting opportunities there. You know? And so, yes, I think it's certainly an interesting time to be looking at it if you're willing to go against the kind of rush of money into US tech, which, you know, we would certainly be advocates of, but probably slightly lone voices. So, you know, but these things, you know, I think there are now signs of some nervousness about the extent to which that rally is sort of carried in the US on the back of what is a very nascent technology theme, the large language models. And right now, these are huge bills for the big companies, but not really very much in the way of you know, earnings opportunities, except for NVIDIA, of course, which is selling the tools to do it. Yeah. But even then, you've got to think, you know, the normal course of industrial events is that competition comes in, prices come down, you know, supernormal profits disappear, and you've got to get on with the hard grind of earning a living, which as a hardware manufacturer is difficult. You know, the software monopolies in the US are probably still pretty well set because they all seem to be. Yeah. But, you know, there'll be many more gyrations to come on this journey.
Yeah. Well, no doubt about it. The Mag 7, a lot of them are actually priced to perfection and they incorporate a lot of growth from AI. And if there's ever a sort of like a hiccup in that level of growth, maybe not, you know, decreasing to single digits, but even not slower double digits, then there's going to be a huge wake up call, a moment of truth in the next year to 2 years. Now, if anybody wants to ask Paul any questions, please put them into the chat bot and I'll read them out. We've had one before, which was from the Wolf of Small Street, and he was just asking about very smart investor, actually. He was asking about IHT and whether that's going to sort of like impact small cap fund managers, particularly in sort of AIM, if the government ever decides to take away that relief for IHT from AIM shares.
Well, you know, this is a really important question right now, and you know, it's one that where you know the government hasn't really given any indications yet about what its intentions are. We all know that it wants more tax, and it needs more tax. Is this a good way to get it? You know, I personally think it'd be a disastrous way to get more tax. But you know, the issue with the IHT legislation is it's very old. It dates back to 1984. With Inheritance Tax Act, and you know, there's plenty of ways it could be updated that wouldn't damage AIM but would raise more tax. And you know, we're yet to kind of hear back from what you know engagement with the government feels like and what their thinking is. In the past, when I've been asked this question, you know, I've always said to people, well, it is a big risk for AIM, but we really didn't think it would be at all sensible for the legislation to change in respect of AIM. You know, I obviously still think that, but you know, there's normally you know some dialogue going on between the industry and Treasury, and that hasn't really started yet. So I think we'll get a better feel in September what the direction of travel is on that. I mean, it's an important question for the market, and you know, there have definitely been noises from the new Labour administration that they are actively, you know, they want a strong public stock market, they want UK small companies to do well. So it would seem very perverse, really, to do one of the most damaging things they could possibly do to all of that by removing this relief. But, you know, I imagine some kind of discussions will take place in September and we'll get a better feel for what their thinking is.
Yeah, I think the budget's in October, isn't it? I think they're putting that's exactly my view. I think they just shoot themselves in the foot because it's a vital part of the funding makeup for businesses needing to get to the next stage of from a small private fast growing onto creating jobs, creating GDP, paying taxes essentially, and growing for the government. So I think they'd be crazy. It'd be a sort of like a negative NPV for them.
Yes. Well, I was lucky enough to last year. I was lucky enough to go to a breakfast meeting with the sort of top Labour people, including Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves in Edinburgh, and they were a great pains to sort of point out that their growth was their number one priority and number one objective, which we all know. These things you typically get to say one thing, and I sort of use my one opportunity to say something to defend public markets and just say, look, do you understand how important these are for UK savers? Yeah. Just imagine a world where there aren't public markets. Who gets to invest in businesses? Well, only people with a lot of business experience. It'd be fine for people like you and me, but it'd be terrible, disastrous for the UK saving public. You would have, really no great alternatives to the bank. Of course, actually, what would happen in practice if they just go to the US and overseas stock markets, which in a way are completely available now in a way they didn't used to be 20, 30 years ago. Yeah. So in a sense, there's a huge amount to defend, and the value of having a UK, prominent UK stock market, public market is difficult to, overstate the importance of that.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, good. Let's move on to some sort of recent stock purchase. We've got a Great Portland Estate, which I understand you participated in the recent placing. Now, this is quite a contrarian pick, I guess. It trades at roughly around about £3.40, £3.50. I think it's got a net tangible book of around about £6.20. So the market's pretty sceptical over its prospects. But it's basically a landlord for office accommodation in central London, also shopping in central London. So it's a play on that sort of like central on the London, about £1.4 billion market cap. What sort of attracted you to this one? Because it's clearly got a huge discount to net tangible book.
Yeah, it's one of two sort of really focused central London office players. The other one being Derwent, and I mean the discount is very striking when you have a look at it, as you pointed out. And I guess it's interesting that real estate stocks in the UK they're one of the sectors which it feels like a real anomaly that they just haven't moved, and they're still trading at the kind of basement valuations. Which is not indicative of what's going on in central London office market. Yeah. The central London office market feels like it's picking up, and actually the trading conditions for these companies are actually notably more optimistic than they were. But they are to a degree yield plays, and but now yields are coming down. You'd have thought these things should be inversely correlated to yields as they normally are, and we think actually the prospects are good. So you could say, well, what's holding it back? And I think actually, my only real kind of thesis on why this has remained such an unpopular sector is that in the US, there's a much bigger real estate crisis. And so given that the UK stock market is actually significantly owned by US investors now, you can feel that they're reluctant to invest in UK property because their own real estate market is in real crisis and remains in real crisis and hasn't really recovered from the COVID shocks. Whereas the central London office market, yes, COVID did some damage to it, but there's still, space is tight, rents are good, lettings are good. It's a very different scene to what's going on in New York, say. So I think this will play out. The anomaly should be corrected at some point. As usual with markets, you just don't know when.
I agree with you. And the management team are seeing some very attractive purchase opportunities. That was the sort of the reason for the placing, wasn't it? They raised about £350 million to buy sort of just properties off good quality properties off distressed sellers. It looks a perfect play where they've got finance access to it. They know how to manage it. And they're picking up people who are forced into selling at very low prices.
Yeah, and they've got a good track record of doing that. In the last crisis, they did a rights issue as well, and they deployed the money very well.
Yeah. Good. Okay, well, let's move on to Boku, which is basically a payments business, largely out in sort of the emerging markets in sort of Asia. It does sort of like over on carrier billing. So it uses the sort of infrastructure from a telco and the money to help people on a consumer basis move, pay for things in a subscription basis, but also move, do account-to-account payments. This one has done really well over sort of 10 years, et cetera. What's the sort of investment thesis here?
Well, Boku has been one of the. It's been a phenomenal success story. It's a phenomenal technology success story in the UK, and they've really built a very effective global business. And I guess that the investment thesis, if one was to really kind of boil it down, why would you invest in Boku? It's obviously a highly rated stock. It's growing really quickly, but what's really the investment thesis? And the investment thesis is basically about operational gearing. And the best way to think about Boku is this is still a company that has been investing so hard for growth. And as a result, it's been depressing its profitability in a way it didn't have to do that. It could be a much more profitable company if it chose to. But and then the question is, well, how much more money do you deploy for growth? How many more goals do you go after? And that's a debate to have with management. But when they feel that they've got the markets they want and they get the growth comes through, the drop through rate of revenue to profit is exceptionally high. So the operational gearing in the company will become phenomenal at some point, and we'll see very rapid earnings growth when they decide not to just sort of redeploy all of the profits straight back into growth. Mm-hmm. And they have got a very good opportunity and it justifies that kind of reinvestment. But the question is really going to be this year and next year, to what degree do they let the margins rise, or to what degree they say, no, we're going to put a foot flat to the floor for reinvestment? There's arguments both ways. I'd rather they let the margins start to rise now because I think that would go down very well in the market. And I think they can afford to do that, given that they're one of the biggest players now, their type. And the current level of investment is already very large. But I think that's the best way to think about it.
Yeah, I mean, they make 25% EBIT margins, but their gross margin is 97%. Exactly. So that's the unit economics is perfect there.
Very few businesses have that kind of gross margin and that drop through rate. Yeah. So, you can see why this is really valuable revenue they're going after to grow. Yeah. But as soon as even the investment rate just flatlines, the growth will very quickly push the operating margin up.
Yeah. And a lot of people in the emerging markets don't have a bank account, and that's why they use the sort of carrier billing as their vehicle to be able to make payments and to send them to friends, money to friends and stuff like that. I totally get it. Okay, good. Let's move to what's we got next? Let's go to another one in that sector, Alpha Group International, which is a B2B Forex payments platform, really the sort of the poster child of the sector. Operating around the sort of the world, it's a sort of like a high touch, high tech business to corporates and to fund managers. Again, it's done really, really well. What's your sort of your latest view on this one?
Yeah, I'm still really keen on this company. I think it's made such a good job of managing its opportunity and making the most of it, and reinvesting the proceeds of its profits into growing new opportunities. And obviously, this alternative banking solutions business that they've developed, which is really targeting providing a banking service to offshore specialist funds that set up in offshore jurisdictions, specialist jurisdictions. So these are kind of real estate funds, private equity funds, and the like. That was really a very, very smart move on their part. And one of the side effects of having done that is these funds, when they want to make a big acquisition, and one of the reasons they'll use Alpha Group is if you want to, let's say you're acquiring a business for $200 million, you need to know that payment is going to go through on the day the business completes, and you don't know when that is. So you'll deposit the money in the bank account that can make the payment for you, probably 1-2 months in advance. You might then get a delay, you might stay there for a while. So these customer balances really build up on Alpha's book. And then when interest rates went up, they started earning significant amounts of interest income from these customer balances. You might say, well, that's quite low quality income. But actually, the level of the balance is remarkably consistent. And actually, it's contrary to expectations. We thought the balances were going to fall. The balances have actually started growing clearly interest rates falling is not so good for that. But when interest rates fall, there's a contrary hedge in the business where actually the number of funds starting up should rise. Mm. And so, and that's really what they want. You know, they want to get more of this core business, win more clients, see the fund flow, the new fund flow picking up. And they should be winning something like 25% of that business as new funds start, because they've really designed this tailored service, which, you know, is, I presume, and I'm not one of these fund managers, I don't know, but I presume is highly attractive to these funds and probably one of the best services. And that, I don't know if you've ever made, you know, you and I don't tend to make very many large payments, but if you ever need to, it's pretty terrifying because you don't really know if the bank's going to make the payment on the day.
Yeah.
The chances are they're going to ring up and say, oh, well, we've got some, you know, we need to verify this payment and we need a whole load more due diligence. This is on the day you're just pushing the button. And, you know, the manager says, oh, we've got to review this. Or worst cases, they just say, sorry, we can't make the payment. Yeah. If there's any kind of money laundering issue, they can't even tell you why. And they can't tell you they're going to hold it up. So, you know, it's not to say, of course, Alpha will do the money laundering stuff, but they will be free of the kind of needless bureaucracy, and the bureaucracy they impose will be absolutely the necessary bureaucracy, nothing unnecessary.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's addressing a very quite simple issue, but a really, really important one.
Yeah. No, my father actually bought a house out in France a few years back, used HSBC. They charged him 3%.
Wow. Okay. Well, there you go.
A bit expensive, but the other side of the other side of the coin for Alpha is that presumably when the markets are going haywire, particularly the Forex markets, a lot of volatility, these guys are going to be doing well because their client base is going to be one of the hedge left, right, and centre. I guess
that's true. And you know, one of the things I really like about Alpha is that they see themselves not as an FX trader. And so they're not, you know, in volatile markets, they're not there busy kind of trading against their clients. There's none of that. They're an advisor to their clients, and they really see themselves as like an outsourced corporate treasury department.
Yeah.
So, you know, they genuinely hedge their clients. They don't encourage them in any way to do speculative trading. So actually, when the currency markets are very volatile, you know, thought their clients would be thinking, oh, thank God I'm using Alpha because I'm not exposed to this. I've hedged just what I needed to hedge. And that's the whole point about what they do is, you know, they're really encouraging their clients to have just a very kind of effective hedging policy, which is not excessive, not speculative, just doing the job that is required.
Yeah, no, I was thinking about those clients or potential clients who haven't hedged.
Well, there you go.
They may get a lot of inbound last Monday morning at 8:30. I don't know.
Indeed.
Right, another one which has done really well for you, Rocketship basically, is Kinetic, which is the sort of services defence business, really supporting the US DOD and the UK MOD and other places around the world. I think it was born out of sort of like robotics originally and has sort of like added different services, particularly in sort of cyber, etc. I mean, it's just done so well, obviously, on the back of really the sound of cannons, you know, in Ukraine and Gaza, and worries over the South China Sea. What's your sort of your latest sort of view on this one?
Yeah, well, it has done very well in the last sort of 6 months. There was quite a lot of delayed gratification with this one in that they bought a business in the US. It didn't quite go to plan. The shares got derated heavily, and it was sitting there on a crazily low rating. In you know, the most attractive sector probably pretty much in the market, where, you know, sadly we're just in a much more bellicose world than we were. And you know, there's this whole debate around, you know, should we invest in defense companies, and unfortunately there's an incredible amount of naive nonsense talked about it, you know. And the idea that it's somehow unethical to invest in this sector, you know, that's completely missing the point. It's unethical not to invest in this sector, but the ethics of defence are all about, you know, avoiding companies which are selling to the wrong countries, to dictatorships, to our enemies. You know, it's absolutely crucial that we invest in the businesses which are going to provide adequate defence to Western democracies. And, you know, Kinetic absolutely sets its stall out really along those lines. It was, I think, originally the research department of the MOD that they then spun out. And so it does really the clever stuff in defence. It does quite a lot of training as well, but, you know, clever technologies, their use, training how to use them, taking on research projects for developing new systems. Obviously, it's quite a lot of work on drones at the moment, which are very topical. It does have businesses outside of defence as well. It's got a broadly based business, you know, but to be able to buy such a kind of high-tech, IP-rich business, even on the kind of rating it's currently on, seems to us to be a very good opportunity.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I was just looking at the actual the PE ratio, and albeit it has gone up, it's still less than 15 times. So, you know, for a good solid, well, it's basically you can't get into this space that you need all those sort of government approvals, defence approvals. So the barriers to entry are just immense, and the order book must be just getting bigger and bigger, I imagine, like all the defense companies.
You know, steadily, but these things don't change overnight. But the evidence is there that, you know, defense spending is picking up, and they won a trading contract from Germany in the last few weeks. And, you know, that's a sign that some of these sleeping giants of defense are waking up. And, you know, there is an extraordinary need to beef up Europe's defenses.
Yeah. And the other thing, actually, is the UK, because we have been spending more than the average in NATO, then we've actually got an expertise. It's one of our good industries. So, you know, if our allies look to the sort of the strengths, either the US or the UK, we're up there with the best, I think, in this.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And that's, you know, that's it's very, this is a really majorly important strategic business for the UK and underestimated. And so, you know, there aren't very many ways for us to get exposure to this sector.
Yeah.
But we still think kinetic is probably the best way.
Yeah. Good. Okay. Well, let's switch sectors. So we've got let's go to the sort of the wealth platforms. We've got AJ Bell, which is basically it's one of the challenges to sort of like, you know, serves a lot of consumers in terms of managing their ISAs and their SIPs and their investments, etc., at a really sort of low cost, affordable way. And there's been a bit of M&A in the activity because their biggest and larger competitor, Hargreaves Lansdown, has just received a bid from CVC, a private equity house, at 16.5 times PE. So there's a bit of consolidations. What's the sort of like from now on? I mean, obviously the shares have done well. What's your sort of your latest thesis on this one?
I think you know, yes, the shares have had a good run. But you know, AJ Bell has been delivering really incredibly impressively, and I'd say ahead of its peer group by some margin. And you know, the growth in the business has been remarkable in what's been, you know, not a straightforward or easy time. They've been winning new business. They've been investing heavily in growth. They have a very kind of simple, targeted, low cost proposition, as you said. And I suppose one of the things we like about it is it's both a consumer platform and an advisor platform.
Yeah.
And those two things are separate because they're very different jobs that they're doing. But they've seen growth, good growth in both platforms, and that gives it just a bit more diversification. You know, Hargreaves never really competed in the advisor platform business. And you know, AJ Bell, the Transact, have both done very well in that market. And you know, it's interesting how well AJ Bell continue to do in that market. So we like the diversification of it. It's you know, it is high quality business. The customers tend to be very sticky. Once I don't know if you know, I have actually been through the experience of changing my own kind of investment platform in the last 6 months, and I, you know, having not done it for like 25 years, I don't imagine I'll do it again for 25 years. It's, you know, it's a quite painful, difficult operation. And you can see why it's very sticky. You know, you tend to just, you know, stick with what you've got unless you've got a very good reason to move.
Yeah. No, you're spot on. I mean, I'll just give you another data point. I mean, I've been a customer of AJ Bell for probably over 20 years now, and I've never had any problems. I've always held it out as the best for me. The other one I do use is Hargreaves Lansdown, and I've used a lot of them, like Barclays, HSBC, and a bunch of others. And those two are sort of head and, for me personally, are head and shoulders above anything else, no doubt about it. So I won't be moving this now.
Glad to hear it. As a shareholder in AJ Bell.
Yeah, no, I'm not that big. Okay, we've got a question coming in from Nigel Batty Seams. I don't know if you've ever looked at Avon Technologies, which used to be Avon Rubber, and then because it did the masks and did cattle, sort of like, you know, rubber, it sold the cattle business. Has now gone into sort of armor and head protection. I don't know whether you've ever had a look at this one at all. The shares have done pretty well on a turnaround, I think.
Yeah, it's, we, as you probably know, we divide up our work by sector, by different analysts, and this one is my colleague David looked at this one rather than me, so I don't have anything useful I can say on that one because I haven't looked at it for a long time.
Okay, yeah, no problems. I'll just put the chart up. Now, I've got some good news, Nigel. I'm speaking to Richard Crowe on Thursday, who wants to talk about this one. So if you hold that question, and we'll pick it up on Thursday morning. So thanks for that anyway. Good. Okay, well, let's move to another one. We've got Trainline, which is basically a ticketing platform for the UK, and also has been branching out overseas. What's your sort of your thoughts on this one? Because obviously the government has been putting a lot of noises together in terms of nationalizing the franchises, and potentially, and I don't know whether they have, and I'm not sure they have, just thinking about, you know, connecting those in ticketing, etc. So what's sort of your view on sort of Trainline? Still growing very well, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, when the government made that announcement, it seemed to spook investors a lot about nationalizing railways. They did it from Trainline's office, which is...
Oh, did they?
Yeah, they did it from Trainline. They went in. So, you know, the idea that that was somehow bad for Trainline, and they weren't trying to send that message.
Yeah.
And, you know, the really significant thing for Trainline in the last 6 months, I'd say, is that the government announced that they're not going to build a competing system, a ticketing system. So, there was quite a lot of concern from previous announcements that... You know, the government say, well, we could save some money on this, let's just build our own. And then they realized exactly how difficult that was going to be and how expensive it was going to be. You know, bear in mind, this system, this beautifully simple system that you get when you use the Trainline app, costs an absolute fortune to make and run. You know, there's simplicity and elegance in design is expensive generally. And, you know, a heck of a lot goes into creating that delivery of information and ease of use and access and, you know, ticket handling and so on. And it's been, you know, Trainline is effectively the incumbent ticketing provider in the UK. they actually, sometimes when you think you're not using them, let's say using ScotRail's ticketing system or whatever, you know, it's white labeled by Trainline. Sorry, give me 1 second. sorry, my computer's about to run out of...
put some power in there, yeah.
It'll just get cut off. So
you're saying basically the ScotRail run off the same platform.
I think it's ScotRail, but they white label to quite a lot. You know, there are competitors, so the LMER app is a competitive app and you know, not a bad one. But Trainline, you know, I think most train users have a Trainline app on their phones and use it. And the, you know, the percentage of e-ticketing that they do is pretty remarkable. You know, I think that, you know, the biggest risk to Trainline, in fact, the only real risk to Trainline in the UK is that the whole kind of ticket pricing thing is so massively simplified that there isn't, you know, the Trainline's job becomes too easy and easy for other people to do. And, you know, and the chances of that happening, I see, is very, very low because we have, even if they nationalize big chunks of the railway service, they're still going to be competing lines. You know, our ticketing is unbelievably complex and it could be simplified quite a lot and that'd still be fine for Trainline. And I don't think it's just going to suddenly be just like, this is just totally simple. You can just use a very basic app to do all your ticketing. I don't think we're going there, not anytime soon. Of course, so the incumbency position in the UK is pretty strong, I think. And you know, that worry over nationalising the railway is, you know, not the right concern to have over Trainline. That's just slightly missing the point. And the opportunity in Europe, you know, remains very good, and really good progress in Spain, pretty good progress in Italy, France and Germany still too sort of nationalist in their protectionist practices, but at some point are probably going to become a bit easier. But even if we just focus on France and on Italy and Spain, that's a pretty good opportunity. And it's already, you know, it's already a powerful app in the European rail space. And obviously, the, you know, the vision of the future is you have one app that really does for the whole of Europe. Can they get there? You know, I think eventually, yes. And they're in the best position to do that.
I know it's not in their name, but do they actually link up at all with the buses in the UK or the coaches or anything like that? Because that would be pretty useful as well, I guess.
It would be useful, yes. And not as far as I know. And that would be good because then, you know, you could propose alternative routes and all of that. If the train's running slow, as it often does, or if it's just cancelled, it'd be nice if they could actually say, well, by the way, you could get on a bus. And you know, this is the best route, and I'll buy your ticket. That would be very nice.
Yeah,
and for anyone who's ever been in one of those situations, as I have, trying to get the Stansted Express, that was just cancelled.
But also, it's sort of like, you know, you get to the end of a train line, and there's no actual train. Like, for instance, if you want to go down, which I have done for holiday, if you want to go down Pembrokeshire down to St David's, you've got to get off the train at half of West, and then it's 30 miles till you get to St David's. You either hitchhike or you get a bus.
Yeah.
I mean, so you got no choice, have you? You know, sort
of. No, that is true. Yes, they should have a hitchhiking app for that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. Good. Right. Let's move to another one in the transport train. In fact, is Traxys, which is a software and hardware business that does a lot of the clever software and smart ticketing, and also sort of like it does surveillance of the track to make sure that it isn't damaged or anything like this, and it's branching out into the US as well. The shares have taken a bit of a bath recently for a really usually a high quality, you know, sort of business. And I was looking at the numbers, and I frankly couldn't believe it. It's on 13.5 times PE, and the reason why the shares took a bath was because the government apparently brought the general election forward, which has delayed a whole bunch of orders in the UK, and they've also seen some elongated sales cycles. But is this a buying opportunity for a really high quality company here, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, I obviously like to think it is. I mean, they tried to grow a business in the US, and that was a bit disappointing so far. So we'd like to see that pick up. I mean, Traxys is a little bit of a mix of some really high quality businesses and some lower quality businesses, and clearly, you know, that's why they had this trouble. And they sort of slightly got shown up for the sort of lower quality end of their business.
Right.
I think, you know, the extent to which it's true that this is a great buying opportunity depends on the extent to which these were one-off problems that get solved.
Yeah.
Okay. We won't know that for a few months. But, you know, there are some great businesses within Traxys portfolio that will hopefully start to deliver a kind of results that will re-rate the shares. So, yeah, I very much hope so.
Yeah, I think they've got a year-end trading update. They usually do it sometime later this month, actually. So we may get a better view of sort of forward visibility. But I know at their last statement, they did hold their FY25 year-ending July. Yeah. They did hold those forecasts, and that's where you get the 13.5 times PE.
Exactly. So the question is, are those the right numbers? And I guess we'll find that out when they next update.
No, it does look you're right. Is it a value trap or is it a value play? But traditionally, it's always been well priced. Okay, let's move sectors. Another one into the really topical on the government is all things property. The sort of the key thrust seems to be from Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves to build lots more affordable homes. And the sort of the one company right at the centre of that, let's start with that one, Vistry House Builder, which has moved to 100% affordable homes sort of builder, split really 2/3 using the housing association partnerships and 1/3 they'll sell themselves. What's your sort of your latest on this one? They seem to have really not put a foot wrong of late. The shares have done so well compared to a lot of the other house builders.
They have, and you know, I should give the credit to my colleague Scott for this one. He's really kind of done the work on it and stuck his neck out. And you're probably aware there were quite a few, well, there were some very sceptical analysts about Vistry in the city who were writing sell notes much lower down and worried that the partnership business wasn't going to come through. And because they build the social houses in partnerships where they get external funding. And that's really where the big difference between them and traditional house building model is, where the house builder puts the money, funds the development themselves. You know, this is a much more capital-like model. And really, it attracted a huge fan club from US investors who had seen this kind of thing happen in the US and thought, yeah, this is going to happen in the UK. We should back this. And the US investors were piling in when a lot of UK investors were worrying about it, thinking, oh, we're not sure if this is going to work, and selling out. And actually, the company has really delivered in spades and now gone into the FTSE 100. So, you know, we our time as a shareholder with this one is limited because when they go to the FTSE 100, we don't keep them forever.
That's a quality problem, Paul.
It's a quality problem. We like it we love it when it happens. And this has been, you know, it's been good. But the government absolutely needs Vistry to succeed to deliver on its pledges to build more houses. And, you know, we need more detail on that whole policy to see how it's going to be delivered, if it's going to be delivered. But, you know, there remains a lot of skepticism in the industry about it. You know, I, as an individual, really want them to succeed at it. I think it's such an important thing to achieve, and it's been an area of massive underachievement of successive governments, but it's a hard thing to bring about. And you have to change the planning legislation. You have to do some things that some of your electors are not going to like locally. And that's a tough thing for a politician to do. And then you've got to bring the industry with you and get them to invest and start building, which means the finances have to be available. You have to have a lot of trust between the industry and government policy that they're not just going to kind of turn around and remove all the benefits, say, or all the things they said. So we'll see how it plays out. And I hope it does play out well. But I know that there's a lot of difficult stuff to do to make that work.
Yeah. And I think the advantage of that sort of model where you get third party funders up front means that you don't get the working capital or work in progress tied up. So they're suggesting they're actually going to release about £1 billion to shareholders over the next 3 years through buybacks and through special dividends and normal dividends. So anyway, really well done on that one. Now, another one which has done well. I mean, the housing market is supposed to be on the floor, but another one you've done really well is the UK's largest sort of property franchise estate agent. It's called the Franchise Property Group. It recently merged with Belvoir. It's a collection of sort of big brands, or Belvoir, Hunters, I think Country and Wide or something like that. So it's got some really good, well-known names. 50% is lettings and 50% is sort of transactions. What's your sort of your latest thesis on this one? I mean, obviously, if the housing market picks up, it's going to continue to do well. But the shares have done very well also.
They have. We really like this company. And you'll probably be aware of the history here was Belvoir floated many, many years ago. And about a year later, I think, the Property Franchise Group floated. Both franchise lettings businesses when they floated. Weren't really into estate agency very much at all. And the elegance of a franchise model for these lettings businesses is that you then get very dedicated managers of your businesses who, they're business owners, and they pay the franchise for the right to operate, for sort of back office support, for some loans to kind of get into business. And the whole kind of business model is given to them, but you get very committed managers. And that's really what drives the key to that sort of franchise success. And both these businesses did very well, including in lockdown when, it was a really tough period, but the franchise businesses came through that in good shape. Mm-hmm. And we'd had both of them in our VCT. I think we, like several other shareholders, have been saying to them for many years, look, why don't you two just get together? Because, you do the same thing very well. And a bigger business is just going to make a much more investable proposition for the market. And, as these things take a long time to bring off, and there's always somebody who doesn't want it for career reasons or whatever. But eventually, they've kind of done the right thing. They've merged. I think it's a great merger. It's a strong business. It's a strong proposition. And we think it's been incredibly robust, even through some pretty difficult times, as you said. There are clearly beneficiaries of the, in some ways, are beneficiaries of the fact that there's been an undersupply of properties for sale and an increase in rentals. Mm. And the rental market's become, if you like, more important to UK residents. And that's actually good for this business.
Yeah. No, really well done. Is that sort of like a feature at all of the sort of the Marty Fund? With these companies helping to develop it, do you sort of like, make suggestions and sort of like give them a nudge to move into certain directions if there's a potential value opportunity there?
I mean, with the smaller companies, particularly the ones we have in the VCT, where we sometimes have pretty big stakes in these companies, then where there's clearly a job to do, and insofar as we think we can have some insight into it, and quite often our conversations with management teams will have an element of that.
Because you're an advisor, aren't you, on, is it Fadal Partners, which is the software business for royalties and rights?
Observer on that one.
Okay, well, let's move to technology. We've got Solid State, which basically they do sort of rugged electronics designed into really high performance and difficult environments, things like aerospace, defense, industrial applications, where they have sort of like long product life cycles, etc. Again, the shares have done really pretty well. The only side, I suppose, is on the industrial side. They've had a bit of destocking of late. What's your sort of your latest view on this one?
Yeah, it's in an interesting position, this one, and it's really, David knows this better than I do, but
yeah,
you know, I think what's a little bit confusing about it is that the forecast earnings are due to drop in the next financial year, and that's in part because, for good reason, that some of the profits they were expected to make in the following year have moved into the year earlier, so they've had a bumper 2024 financial year, and hence they moved some profits out of 2025. But the area, you know, the area they've been winning business in, it comes back to the defence sector, and they've been winning some big orders, big new orders from NATO for communications equipment, which is one of their product areas, for the electronics that go into communications equipment. And actually, I think they must be pretty well set to win more business in defence. Well, I'm certainly hoping that that's not in the numbers. So, I'd be disappointed if the earnings do drop as much as the forecast.
Yeah.
But we'll see. So, you know, I think they've set the forecast pretty conservatively to say, well, this is what we really kind of feel we know we can do. But also the destocking issue hit the business. So in some ways, the fact they had a bumper 2024 despite destocking shows you the extent of that. So the destocking should come to an end reasonably soon, and but they're probably not forecasting that. I wouldn't have thought.
Yeah.
So yeah, we really like this business, and it's one that has over delivered significantly and consistently, and we hope there's more of that to come.
Yeah, and you would have thought. I mean, it's a market cap 160 million. You'd have thought at some point in time somebody's going to take a number on these, because they've got, again, presumably approvals into some of the, you know, the highest sort of confidential programs on sort of defense or an aerospace, and that gives you access to customers. So strategically, for somebody wanting to get into the markets and particularly the clients that Solid State have, it's got a bigger strategic value than currently reflected on the market.
I think that's probably right.
Okay, good. Let's move to, we've got a slightly smaller business, Eurego International, which basically does autonomous baggage handling vehicles for airports, particularly for sort of like Singapore. And I think it's also got a big program with BA. It did a recent placing at around about £1. Market cap is 36 million. Still early doors, but seems to be moving in the right direction, because we all know how often baggage gets lost at airports.
Absolutely. I mean, this, you're right. This is an early stage. Right now it's in our AIM VCT. We did back this at flotation. It has a mature kind of automotive business in there that's been around for a long time. Has 5 or 6 million of revenues. And then the growth side of the business is all about these autonomous vehicles or baggage handling at airports. And that is a bit of a holy grail. Airports provide a very suitable regulated space for autonomous vehicles. And I think we'll see them in airports long before we see them on roads, because you have a much more controlled environment to let autonomous vehicles loose in. And the reason why Changi Airport is really such a big champion of Eurego's technology is because in Singapore, they just don't have enough people to do this baggage handling. So they're really kind of a bit desperate for an autonomous system. And Eurego doesn't just make the vehicles themselves, they make a software platform to run to manage all the vehicles for an airport, and maps out the whole airport, all the routes and what's going on. So there's kind of control software in there as well, which is, I think is a great part of the business. But it's early days, and what we're waiting for at the moment is the results from the latest trial that Changi Airport have been running, which is the kind of second phase of trials they've been doing. And if that gets the green light in the next few months, that'll be a big positive for the company.
Yeah, and you would have thought sort of like more longer term, sort of the secular, these type of things could be used in ports and other particular, areas, maybe, nuclear establishments, anything, defence establishments, all these sort of stuff, particularly in ports whereby you've got a risk of, sort of like drug trafficking, arms dealing, stuff that comes through from sort of like, overseas or in just from third party from areas where there's potentially you could compromise if you have humans in there that that just, you know, I've perhaps been watching too many films. I don't know. But...
yeah, I don't know. I mean, Auriga won't go into ports anytime soon, but, you know, maybe that'd be a very different kind of vehicle.
Yeah, okay. We've had another question from Nigel Batty Seams. He's basically asking, Paul, do you have a sort of a minimum market cap threshold with the fund at all, or you really look at it sort of like with your IHT and your VCT sort of stuff?
Yeah, they vary. So the VCT doesn't really have a minimum market cap.
Yeah.
So we're pretty, when we make an investment, we want it to be more than 50 million market cap within a couple of years.
Yeah.
Okay. Because you can get a bit stuck end, you can get a bit stuck at the bottom end of AIM. So we're looking for companies that have that capacity to grow and to become significant enough really to get investor attention.
Yeah.
For our small cap funds, for liquidity reasons, we have to have, you know, a kind of discipline over market caps. And, you know, anything below about 150 million is pretty difficult for the small cap fund. Mm. And perhaps even a bit bigger than, you know, bigger than that is would be better.
Yeah.
And then for our inheritance tax portfolio service, AIM portfolio service, yeah, it'd be very difficult to go below 100. And, you know, again, we need companies that are going to be kind of regularly liquid because we have clients coming and leaving the service, so they need to be able to trade. Mm. So, you know, liquidity is a big focus for fund managers, and it does make, it's left the bottom, the really bottom end of AIM a little bit marooned at the moment for liquidity because there aren't enough kind of natural fund buyers for that end of the market. And, you know, maybe that's very good for private investors because they can kind of, you know, potentially find things that fund managers can't buy at that point. But, you know, it's an area of some concern, and the VCT legislation tightened up so much that it doesn't let the VCT invest really other than in very restricted ways at the bottom end of AIM. So, you know, that is, again, that's something to be a good discussion to have with the people in the new government looking at this. The market, how, you know, how to get this end of AIM functioning better.
Well, it isn't just fund managers who struggle with liquidity. I mean, I certainly struggle with liquidity, anything less than 100 million. Yeah. I bet you do the same. You know, you try to put 50 grand into a stock, sometimes there's just like no bid, and they only give you a few hundred quid's worth. And you just think, I can't be sitting here for all day trying to put orders through. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I mean, if I could change one of the VCT rules in a way that I thought was both practical and realistic and doable, it would be to allow VCTs to buy secondary shares on the AIM market. Because it's one of the things that's not very widely appreciated, but VCTs are not allowed to buy shares on the market.
I didn't realize that.
Unless they're newly issued.
Yeah.
We have to buy them in deals only, and they've got to be qualifying transactions.
Yeah.
Whereas pre-2016, we could buy shares on the market. So if one of our companies fell to a kind of crazy level, we could at least buy shares and defend it and help it kind of see it through those kind of moments. Whereas now we're not allowed to do that. We can buy shares on the full list, just not on AIM.
Yeah.
And actually, I think that would be a very simple, costless rule to change. It wouldn't put the price of VCTs up at all. I don't think it would be problematic with the EU approval, which they need to get the sunset clause through and so on and so on. But, you know, so that would be a very practical rule change that would actually really help at that end of the market.
Well, we'll leave that one with you, Paul. Get on your bat phone to Rachel Reeves. You're right. That seems like a no-brainer to me. Okay, let's move to we've got a bigger company. We're getting a sort of fallen angel, YouGov. And it made a lot. It's basically the polling and market research business in the UK. It made quite a strategic acquisition probably about 12, 18 months ago of GfK's sort of consumer panel business. So it's now got a consumer panel of sort of like £27 million. But it's struggled recently of perhaps integrating that, but also some of the growth has not been as hot and the shares have sort of fallen off. What's your sort of your latest view on this one? Because it's still a pretty big business, but it sort of has come down quite a lot from its highs.
It's come down hugely from its highs. And so, you know, so exactly a good question to be asking, is this now crazily cheap?
Yeah.
Or is there something profoundly wrong with the company? And we've been having this debate internally and we've got different views of it. You know, and I think my view is that the kind of core, the reason you buy YouGov is essentially because you think it's got the best panel of data in the industry. and that they can provide the most accurate data to corporates and the best, therefore the best market research product. And I still think that's true. And you know, they would, you know, in their defense, they were pointing out in the recent results, well, you know, we actually got the UK election predictions more accurate than the exit polls, which is kind of, you know, that's crazily good. If I haven't verified that statement, but that's what they were claiming.
They didn't 4 years ago, 5 years ago, though. I remember
this is true. So I think their panel data is extremely good. Yeah. And, you know, there's a chat about the detractors of this kind of research label. What about fraud and what about people who don't pay attention who just tick the boxes and trying to earn the rewards? Well, the YouGov are incredibly good at spotting that and basically filtering you out. So that's what you do. So they get, you know, their whole business is focused around getting these, you know, dedicated, genuine people who want to express their views on these topics. And I guess one of the reasons you'd sign up with YouGov is you know the brand and you think, well, actually, this is a platform to share my views in a world that appears to be not very interested in my views. And that's, you know, so because, you know, genuinely, most of us have very, you know, very tiny voices and very little, apparently very little say in, you know, our opinions don't count for a lot in the political process. Unless you're kind of spending vast amounts on media and you know, attracting huge amounts of attention to yourself. But YouGov is a way you can express your opinion and it will count. It will be in a survey. It will be accurately recorded. And the acquisition they made, no problems with that. Nobody's saying they paid too much for it. It's a genuinely attractive asset that they acquired. So actually, you know, the question now was this just a kind of big own goal on the part of the management that they had a very good January this year and they decided to invest really heavily, push their costs up pretty massively, and then found that suddenly in May, June, the market just wasn't there for their products. Mm-hmm. And they had a huge downgrade to profitability. And therefore, can the management sort of do the similar kind of self-help to fix it? And that's the debate is, you know, is there a kind of any big fundamental problem with the business, or was this a kind of a bit of a management screw up, really, in pushing the cost base and misreading the tea leaves over the direction of demand? You know, clearly the backdrop is more difficult for them, but if they genuinely have this kind of industry leading product still, then they've got all kinds of avenues to kind of fixing that and coming out the other side. You know, I'm still in that camp. Yeah. But, you know, to kind of really convince the market, it's going to need some delivery. So, it's in a slightly kind of wait and see moment at the moment. I think it's, you know, attractive for the brave. You know, I remain keen on it. But, you know, some of my colleagues are pushing me harder over this, thinking, well, actually, you know, is there some problem with the quality of the business here?
Mm. And would it be a beneficiary or a sort of like a... it could be disrupted by generative AI on this one. I would have thought if you've got this 27 million person sort of like historical database, especially this panel, you've got a lot of data to mine. And if they came out with a product that could predict to large corporates how to actually to sort of test their advertising, their marketing, which they spend literally hundreds of billions a year to be able to accurately predict whether it's going to be successful and how to improve it, then it'd be an absolute winner. But clearly, what's your thoughts anyway?
No, I definitely think it's a winner from AI, as are all the kind of real data owners, plus the global data as well. But, you know, the question is how much they have to invest in that kind of technology and can they get a good return on that investment? That's kind of the key question. But, you know, you're not going to just be able to type into Google or some large language model, you know, tell me what people think about my brand right now and get a great answer. That's not going to happen.
Not on Twitter.
and actually, the kind of AI that these companies are using is much more really about machine learning than it is about large language models at the moment. Sure, they can use large language models to maybe assess question answers more in real time and sort of, you know, improve some of the kind of running of the panels from doing that. But in terms of really increasing the accuracy of their market research is the holy grail here. That's probably going to be a machine learning phenomenon, which they've been using already. That's why they're so good at what they do already.
Yeah. Okay, good. We've got a question coming from Progress is Everything. He's asking about, and I don't know whether you've ever owned it, but this sort of like, well, it's Cake Box, which is the sort of like the UK's number one franchiser of sort of fresh cream cakes. It's got those iconic sort of like looking shops, etc. Got a bid actually, probably around about 18 months ago from the Australian Cheesecake Company. Shares have improved significantly. I don't know if you've ever had a look at this one at all, or whether
I've not looked at it for a couple of years, so I'm really out of date on it, I'm afraid. Okay. So yeah, probably okay. Not to comment on that one.
Okay, you should go down one of the shops, try one of their fresh cream cakes. do a bit of market research. Okay, let's move to another one which has sort of like fallen quite a lot, is Learning Technologies Group, which is basically a corporate learning and training and a talent management provider for some of the big businesses in the States. It bought a company, GP Strategies, in the US about a year ago, I think. And then it did a placing at £9.20 to help fund that one. And it seems to have integrated okay, but there's obviously had problems with GP Strategies. The shares have come off a lot. What's sort of your latest on this one? I think their debt's come down a lot, actually. They're quite cash generative.
I might be misremembering here, Paul, but I don't think the placing was as high as £9.20.
You're right. Yeah, I've got a complaint. That was the YouGov one, wasn't it? That was the YouGov one.
Yes. But they did. Yes, GP Strategies was also a little bit longer ago than that.
Yeah,
and you know, this is an acquisition vehicle. This company, and they have made a series of value-driven acquisitions. So they tend to buy things because they can get good deals on them, and they can buy them cheaply, and they do make money on their acquisitions. But what they then don't have is enough of a real kind of business engine to drive organic growth consistently. And that's really where they've kind of suffered in the last couple of years, is that organic growth has not been coming through. And last year there were downgrades. This year there's been another one. That's why the shares fell over again. But they've been very good at managing the balance sheet, and they made a disposal actually just in the last few weeks, which will take the net debt right down. And so it puts them in a pretty strong position. And, you know, any questions one might have had about the balance sheet have now been removed. I mean, it'd be interesting to see what they do. I mean, they must be feeling a little bit like the market is just sort of crazily unfriendly to them. And, you know, maybe this company, maybe this is one that should go private at some point. I don't know. But, you know, they have businesses that should be worth more than the current market cap, put it that way. But it's generally been a well-managed company, but they, you know, they've got to kind of figure out strategically what's the right way forward for this business. And that's become a bit less clear since the last downgrade. And clearly with a strong balance sheet, they're in the driving seat now. They can choose the options they want to choose, you know, where they want to go down. They've removed that element of kind of being pushed around by the debt, which is good to see. So we'll have to see how this one unfolds in the next 6 months.
How discretionary is their services? Because they've got sort of like 70%, or they say they've got 70% is SaaS or revenues, which are sort of all revenues which are under long-term contracts, etc. So they say they've got visibility. It's the sort of the other sort of transactional stuff that seems to, you know, be more fluctuating.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, they came from online learning. This company. Hence the name Learning Technology.
Yeah.
And you know, some of that online training is more discretionary than other bits. And you know, there's no doubt that they've been suffering from a kind of, you know, lack of appetite from corporates to spend as much as they might do on training. And there is that sort of cyclical element to the business, which is, you know, it's a bit more cyclical than it's been comfortable in. And so they've been finding the market pretty difficult for the last couple of years. But that's not to say that that it's all swung around by that. As you say, there is a big chunk of dependable, high quality revenue in here. And the most puzzling thing in the last statement was about the some certification issues they've had over security in the US. And you know, we haven't spoken to them since then. It feels like that's clearly something they've got to sort out. And I don't know what gave rise to that.
Yeah. No. It seems to be. They probably haven't filed some paper correctly. I'm not sure, but anyway, it means that it's classified. It's basically clearance, isn't it, to be able to work for the sort of the government. Yeah. Would it be impacted by AI, this one, at all? Because I mean, obviously, you've seen that in your student side with Chegg in the States, and this is sort of corporate. I know it's more sort of like regulated, so it's probably less impacted. But I don't know what your thoughts on that one.
I mean, that must have been one of the worries investors had. Yeah. Right now, I would say not. In fact, AI is more of an opportunity for them than a threat.
Yeah.
They was chatting to Jonathan, about the CEO, about that last time we did speak to him. And you know, part of their business is very close to Microsoft. Mm. And so they're kind of partnering with Microsoft and deploying, AI as usefully as they can in online learning kind of applications.
Yeah.
It remains to be seen how powerful that becomes. And, right now we're going through a bit of a backlash against, corporate use of large language models, because it turns out you can't really depend on large language models for very much.
Yeah.
And yes, they might produce you a great sort of slide, or they might produce you an entirely bogus slide that's kind of utter rubbish. And it's a bit of a lottery which one you get. So that's not really going to be very good for training right now.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Okay, good. We've got a question from Steve Waters. I don't suppose you've... he basically is asking about a number of couple of companies, but Couth, have you got any views on Couth, which is basically the telemedicine healthcare business born out in the UK, got a really strong position with schools, etc. here, and then won some really transformational contracts out in the States with California, and has also got Pennsylvania sort of like potential as well. I don't know if you've got any thoughts on this one.
Yeah, we do. And essentially we like Couth, but it remains at a fairly early stage. So there's not a risk. This is, it's still at a fairly risky developmental stage in its business growth. It managed to become a sort of major supplier to the NHS, every time you hear the word NHS, you have to kind of think to yourself, this is a nightmare customer. It's the old nightmare customer in any business. So if you can do that well with them, then you're doing a lot right, because they're extremely tricky to sell to.
Yeah.
I take my hat off to them over that. But, the NHS side of the business has been, I think, a bit more difficult in the last 18 months. And then these major new, the big win for them was California. And that was an incredible achievement to win that contract as a non-US business. And obviously they have to kind of couch themselves as a US business. And we're in the phase where they're just starting to kind of deploy that contract. And this is where we really need good execution. If they can do really well in California, then there's probably quite a few other states they can win similar business in. And just, for viewers who don't know this company, it's all about delivering effective online therapy and counseling sessions for adults and young and teenagers. Mm-hmm. And, it's being able to deliver that service at scale is difficult to do. And it turns out this is, not at the high severity end, but at the kind of, the more standard end of treatment need, this can be delivered pretty effectively online. And in fact, there's some benefits to doing it online. It's less sort of invasive, and you maybe answer more truthfully to an online session than you might do face to face. I mean, I don't know the ins and outs. This is one argument for online sessions. It's kind of somehow a bit easier because you've got a little bit of remove from the person you're talking to. I'm sure there's some drawbacks to having it online too. So it's not only a one-way street, but Couth seemed to have developed a very effective system. And as you know, there's a mental health crisis, particularly among younger people. And so this is a very timely service and hopefully cost-effective way of delivering it for these big health services.
Yeah, well, for a UK provider in telemedicine to be able to win sort of at least one massive contract in the States, I mean, it says everything, to be perfectly honest. It's got to be good. They wouldn't be doing that. There's no about it. Steve's asking about intelligent ultrasound. Have you ever looked at that one at all? It's basically...
Yeah, we own that one in the VCT.
Yeah, it does. I does sort of ultrasound sort of training for sort of nurses, but it's also developed this AI application that I think GE is very interested in. In fact, I'm not sure whether it bought it actually, but what's your sort of your latest on this one?
So what's happened with that one is GE have bought the AI part of their business. So intelligent ultrasound has a long-standing business where they provide, if you like, training systems to train nurses how to use ultrasound and to do scans. And that business probably has about 10 million of turnover.
Yeah.
It's not really a growth business. but it should make money as a standalone business. And they were redeploying all of the funds from that and a lot more into developing products which could be used in the clinical market for different specific conditions where the software would then, as you were doing a scan, as a nurse was doing a scan, they'd be able to say, actually, we think there's a high risk of this condition, or, you know, helping the diagnosis from looking at the scan, analyzing it and saying, yeah, this is indicative of XYZ condition. And that's a market where there's a big growth opportunity, but also a lot of competition, and really dependent on GE selling that through. And GE were being a bit slow about selling that through. And so the company had had a series of fairly disappointing updates. The shares have been kind of trashed on the AIM market, sadly. And this is a case of where the AIM market just doesn't really work for that kind of business. Whereas a startup company doing that had had raised £60 million at some fancy valuation, didn't have anything like what Intelligent Ultrasound had had. And you can see that the discrepancy between what is happening on the AIM, the junior end of the AIM market, and what's happening in private company space has just never been more extreme. Yeah. And there's vast amounts of money for venture capital. None of it wants to go into AIM. And so we're getting very different outcomes. So the management team had a bid from GE of £40.5 million, I think it was, to buy the clinical AI business. That was more than the market cap of the company by something like 50%.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's 12.5p per share. The shares were trading at 7. Even now they're only at 10.5p. So it seems that the core business is worth nothing and they're going to waste a load of the money they're going to get from GE and not give it back. So this is kind of highlighting a certain dysfunctionality in the market at that end. So
tell me about it.
We're all kind of scratching our heads thinking, look, how can we make this market work better? And you know, more work needs to be done on that, really.
Yeah, you need to get on that bat phone again, Paul, to Rachel Reeves, I think. Okay, let's move to another sector. We've got we've got franchise brands, which is a B2B sort of franchise business that it's got sort of three main divisions. One of them is Pirec, which basically does sort of hydraulic hoses for industrial sort of like applications. You've also got an oil cleaning and catering kitchen cleaning business, Filter, which it bought, and then it's got the final thing is Metro Rod, which basically does drainage services. So it's really sort of the core behind the whole three is that it's essential services that it has decent pricing power because it's reacting to people having problems with blocked drains and needing regulated cleaning. What's sort of your latest on this one? I know it's got a bit of debt because it bought Pirec Europe, but I think the idea is to reduce that.
Yeah, look, we really like this business. And I think part of that is because this essentially the franchising model, which it has, it looks to us like it works really well for these market segments they're in. And we were talking about it in relation to lettings, and it works incredibly well in lettings. Yeah. I think it will work very well in each of these areas they're into. And you know, the franchising model is very resilient. You get real dedication from the franchise operators, forming a partnership with them. We think there's a lot to go for. And you know, the bit of the setback they had recently was, and it'd be interesting to know what your viewers think about all of this. You know, they had this event where, because they bought Pirec, they then became an entity that's deemed by the FRC, the Financial Reporting Council, as being an other area of public interest, or another entity of public interest, the definition of which I don't really know. But they came and said, because we're this, then our audit's going to be delayed and a load more work. And they had, you know, just a massive kind of audit.
Right,
okay. Pain in the neck to get through. They've become a more complicated business, and then a change of partner. And this is an all too common story. And again, this is something that is doing the public stock market no favours. And you know, I don't think the FRC claims to work for investors. In this respect, it's really not. You know, this is a terrible thing for public companies to have to go through. And so they had a real battle together. The accounts were late, and that created some worries and some suspicion. And then the auditor decided to kind of completely relook at everything, and it came out to be just almost exactly the same answer as it was before. So, you know. But these very difficult audit processes are becoming, you know, just a very regular feature of what public companies have to go through. And I don't think this is good. I think we need some major simplification of the audit process. And I'd love to see the FRC driving more in that direction rather than in the direction of saying, are we going to make this more and more difficult and onerous, and our job is to, you know, kind of police everything to the nth degree. Mm-hmm. Actually, what we need are, you know, yes, of course we need audits and they've got to be effective, but we need them to be timely and we need them to be not excessive.
Yeah.
So that, I think that's a bit what's happened to franchise brands, but you know, we really like the business.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of like, I don't want to say this publicly, but I will anyway. You've got people like, you know, so the accountancy body. I mean, it's a bit of a, it's almost like a conflict of interest because they put rules up that help the accountancy firms to sort of like do all their, you know, to do all it. I mean, why a set of accounts now is 500 pages long is just beyond me. I mean, you know.
Well, also, imagine the cost of it.
That's it. Exactly.
Terrifying and
I know, the time
completely disproportionate, really. Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, let's move to final one. Just remind anybody, if anybody wants to ask Paul any questions, please drop them into the chat. I'll read them out. But we'll just run through the final company. We've got FRP Advisory, which is a professional services company with sort of like restructuring, insolvency, forensic accounting, corporate finance. Seems to have done really well. Got a big cash balance as well for buy and build sort of stuff. What's your sort of your It must be a counter-cyclical play, I guess. But even regardless of the UK economy, it's doing pretty well.
Yeah, no, we like FRP and think it's kind of underappreciated by the market.
Yeah,
Has been doing very well. It's a really well-run company. Actually, the number of insolvencies has been rising in the UK. So actually, they're pretty busy on that side. But also, their corporate finance. The corporate advisory side is doing well, so it just feels to us like it's a well run, neat company that's able to grow its earnings, and yeah, feels pretty underappreciated.
Yeah, it's about a £360 million market cap. It's got sort of like £30 million of cash. You strip out the cash, and it's trading on like 13 times PE on a cash adjusted basis. So it's pretty cheap, actually.
Yeah, no, I think that's right.
Okay, brilliant. Well, again, thanks very much, Paul, for all your sort of comments. And just sort of like top level, just going forward, then the next 12 months, how do you see the sort of small cap space? Then would you sort of positive? You've got money to sort of deploy, or
we're pretty positive on it. And you know, there's been a lot written about the number of withdrawals and the sort of. Never-ending kind of cycle of more and more withdrawals from this end of the stock market, but it's beginning to feel like that's really kind of run its course. And we haven't yet got inflows coming in the other direction. The outflows are broadly, you know, for the first month, the numbers last year came out. So last month came out, showing that the withdrawals had stopped. It'd be lovely to see that turn into some momentum in the other direction, but it wouldn't take a lot to turn this market around quite significantly. So yeah, we're feeling pretty positive on that.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thanks everybody as well for all your questions, and look forward, Paul, in touching base in probably about 6 months time. So thanks again.
Wonderful. Thank you, Paul. Great to see you.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.